Il-program li ser tisimaw u għamiġu plilkom biex xew għattajba tal-Bank of Valletta. Campus FM jipprezenta Mhux kelma bejn tnejn, l-intervista tal-Bank of Valletta. Jipprezentaw il-program Father Joe Borch u l-Professur Joe Pirotta.
Father Joe Borch flimkien ma' l-professur Joe Pirotta nistidnukom għall-edizzjoni oħra tal-programm mhux kelma bejtnejn l-intervista tal-BOVO ikolli naqleb l-Ingliż peress illi l-mistidna tagħna hija Ingliża. We have the pleasure of introducing the British High Commissioner Louise Stanton. Say the British High Commissioner, but if I was speaking Maltese, I would have said il-High Commissioner Ingliża. Or would not say even the British High Commission,
but
the Commission, Olia Inglisa, and they chose our bias in Malta. We look at Great Britain as England with some add-ons, not as Great Britain.
Well, don't tell the Scots and the Welsh and the Irish.
Actually, historically, I think that wasn't the reason, Joe. I think historically the reason was that these people who came over in 1800 spoke English. Mm-hmm. So they must be English. Mm-hmm. So everybody who comes from the British Isles is English.
Yes, sir.
Full stop. Mm-hmm. But it's not a national bias in the sense
No. We knew the English. You know, uh-huh. Yeah. And, yeah, I don't know.
No other languages have the same interpretation. I speak Japanese, and quite often they'd much rather use the word for English embassy, because that's more familiar to them than British, because they didn't understand the word British very often.
Yeah, so it's not only the Maltese.
It's not only the Maltese.
People who live in islands, although Japan is slightly bigger than what I am.
Just slightly, yes.
But a personal question, which ambassadors, they say that ambassadors are lie abroad for the good of their country.
Oh, my goodness. I certainly eat and drink a lot abroad for my country. My job, I hope I never lie. I really hope I don't. Because I think you have to be able to trust your representatives abroad. We stand for integrity, and I think it undermines your country. It devalues your reputation if you lie. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but there is the play on words quite naturally on lie with the two meanings of the
living
lie,
abroad.
Lie living somewhere. But a high commissioner and ambassador, like people working in the civil service, you do not represent yourself, but you represent your country.
Yes.
So today there is a very controversial political decision by the government of your country, and you, as the representative of your country, you defend it.
Mm-hmm.
And then tomorrow that government is defeated in parliament, you have another government saying something totally opposite, and you come here 40 hours after your statement and you say exactly the opposite. I am exaggerating a bit, but it could happen. How do you feel in that kind of situation?
Well, yes, my job is to represent the government of the day, whatever their colour. And I have to be politically neutral in that sense, because I have to promote the views of the government and defend their policies. And most of the time I completely agree with what the government is doing, because generally what my government does is good common sense. Sometimes there are issues which are more of conscience, and that can be more difficult for diplomats. And
for example,
I think the Iraq war was a classic example of that. Some people did disagree, and we have a choice. We can either continue in our jobs but having our own private view. You say what you have to say, but you have your own personal opinion, but you keep it to yourself. But if it becomes a matter of conscience that you can't handle, then the Foreign Office is sympathetic to situations like that, and you can ask to be moved to a different area of work, so that, you know, you don't have to talk about the Iraq war if you don't want to. And I know that some diplomats found that a very difficult issue for them personally. A couple famously resigned, but that's, you know, something of their own, that's their personal conscience. And I think it's up to each individual. Most of the time, you know, I agree with what my government is saying. There might be the odd occasion, I can't recall any occasions off the top of my head, but when I don't perhaps agree fully with what their policies are, but that would be for a matter of my own personal reflection.
Would you agree with my perception that one of the ways in which the roles of an ambassador, or rather a British High Commissioner in this case, has changed over the years, is the fact that the High Commissioner today is expected to play a larger role in the commercial side of relations? Before, it was a commercial attaché, and it was very much up to him to do that sort of work. What is your...
Yes, I agree with you. I remember when I joined the Foreign Office in 1990, commercial work was considered one of the kind of poorer relations. You know, it was policy work. Political work was the thing you had to do, and nothing else really mattered. And there's been a distinct shift. And I served in Japan in the early 90s doing commercial work, promoting British exports into the Japanese market. And I remember seeing a significant shift during that time in the early 90s, that commercial work was gaining in importance. And we're seeing a re-emergence of this now with the new coalition government, because they've realised that one of the ways to get us out of the economic recession that we're in is to increase our exports. So I agree. Yeah, commercial work has grown significantly in importance. And that's only right, because politics and commerce, the economy, it's all interlinked these days. It's very hard to kind of draw lines around each of these subjects. They all interlink. So by promoting British exports, by helping companies, we're also helping the British economy. So there we are.
So we're agreeing with the quote, it's the economy stupid, right? Now, if that is the case, how do you personally promote this cause?
How do I help promote British
That's
companies?
Right. How do you actually do it as High Commissioner?
Well, here in Malta, I think British companies have got a fantastic advantage, because Malta is such a great place to do business. It's in the EU, you're in the Eurozone, you speak English, there's this natural affinity for the UK. But, you know, I can help in terms of companies who are wanting to come here for bid for big contracts or whatever, in giving them a briefing about how the Maltese political system works and how business is done in Malta. Also, part of my job is to raise competitiveness issues. If we feel that British companies are not getting equal bites of the cherry compared to Maltese companies under EU rules, then it's my job to raise that with the government and say, you know, perhaps there's an issue here about competitiveness.
Mm-hmm. Can we make a parenthesis here? And instead of talking to the British High Commissioner, we talk to the person.
Right.
Yeah. Will you return to your diplomatic career and to... Which is very distinguished and very, very interesting. You have had such a varied portfolio in your...
That's part of the fun of my job.
Yeah. But let's look at other kinds of fun.
Mm-hmm.
You lived in South Africa.
Yes.
When you were very young, 6 years. And you attended the Dominican Convent School.
Yes.
Okay, so... As a priest, I don't have
the churchman coming out.
But you see, but when we refer to nuns in the Catholic Church, priests have their own jokes about sisters and nuns, which would not be appropriate during this program, because we aired before 9 p.m. in the evening. So if we have a night edition, then I'll tell you those jokes.
Okay. No. Tell me after.
Yeah. But you are living in South Africa?
Yes.
With apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And you are living with the nuns. Two different things, but yes. I would like to ask you about both of them.
Uh-huh.
How was it living in South Africa at the time of apartheid? Or as a young girl and then as you grow, that did not make a difference? You had a kind of sheltered life and...
My memories of South Africa are extremely happy ones. You have to remember, I was a child. We left there when I was 10. But for me, it was a very carefree childhood. The weather was gorgeous. I remember in the summers, me and my sister used to go off on our bikes all day. And my mother would say, well, just make sure you're home in time for tea. You know, she didn't know where we went. We just went off. We met up with our friends. You know, just going out exploring. It was great fun. I also enjoyed being at the convent. The Irish nuns were lovely. They were strict, but they had a great sense of humour. So I had a very enjoyable time at the convent. Apartheid, it's not something that you realise, first of all, being a young child, but it crept into my awareness. Little things like, you know, I remember going to the bank with my mother, and there'd be three different entrances, one for white, one for black, and one for coloureds, because they were segregated in that way. And I remember asking my mother why, and she said, well, this is because it's apartheid. And I said, it doesn't really make sense. And she said, no, I know it doesn't, but that's how it is. And I remember another occasion. We were doing a tour around Soweto, the black township near Johannesburg, which you could only enter as white people. We could only enter as part of organised tours. And we were doing a tour with some visiting family. And I saw an albino African lady. And I said, but Mummy, what's she doing here? She's white. And my mum said, yes, but she's... really an African.
A black white.
Exactly. It's just such a contradiction. And it just really highlights the illogicality of apartheid, to discriminate against people because of the colour of their skin. I mean, it's just such a superficial way of differentiating between people. I realised sort of at quite an early age the pointlessness of apartheid, but it was a difficult thing for me to really kind of grapple with in a wider political sense. When we returned to the UK, obviously I maintained an interest in South Africa, and I remember being asked in my interview for the Foreign Office, how long do you think apartheid will last? This was in 1990. And I remember saying, I have no idea, you know, but I will be one of the biggest supporters when it finishes, because this is just such a nonsensical policy. And I was delighted that much sooner than I could have imagined, apartheid came to an end.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. You meet people who are educated by the nuns, and some love them. Some hate them. I have the impression that you are among those who love them.
Yes, they were very sweet, very kind.
But there is the policy of the British government to speak in favour of nuns.
No, that's an entirely personal opinion. But they were utterly charming. They had a lovely sense of humour. I mean, you know how you have really daft memories, but one of my memories is that our school uniform was blue, but on St. Patrick's Day we were allowed to wear green ribbons in our hair, which I was always very excited about, because when you're that age, the difference in wearing sort of green ribbons instead of blue is a big deal.
Yeah.
And also, it's not strictly uniform.
Exactly, it's slightly so rebellious. Yes.
That's important. When the time came and you decided you wanted to join the Foreign Office, why did you want to join the Foreign Office?
Well, when I always knew that I wanted to travel and learn languages. I'd got the kind of the travel bug, the sort of the thirst for foreign culture in South Africa as a child. And I always knew I wanted to travel. As a child, I didn't have great ambition. I wanted to be an air hostess because...
Well, that's normal.
A very high ambition.
Well, normal. For me, you know, at the time...
I was going to be an international footballer.
Yeah, I wouldn't have even known what an ambassador or a high commissioner was when I was seven. But when I was seven, I wanted to be an air hostess because, to me, they travelled a lot. They got to see lots of foreign countries, and I thought that was great. As I got older, into my late teens, I decided I wanted to become a bilingual secretary. Because that would involve me using languages, which I loved. And I remember saying, I had this argument with my mother that went on for some time, over a period of months, when I was about 16, 17. She insisted that I should go to university. And I was bored of school, and I said, I don't want to go to university. I want to go and earn some money, and I can be a
Sounds
bilingual
familiar.
Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she put her foot down and said, I don't care what you do with the rest of your life, but you're going to university. So I ended up at university. Of course, by about week three, I was in love with the whole concept of university, enjoying both the academic side and the social side and the kind of life skills that comes with it in sort of gaining your own independence, but in a safer environment. And... so I thought, okay, yeah, I can do more with my life. You know, if I'm doing a degree, I can do more than be a secretary. So I still wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I spent my third year of my degree teaching English in Munich, having some vague idea that I'd like to be a teacher of foreign languages. And I think in about the second week of teaching English, I was teaching in a secondary school, a grammar school and a technical college, I realised it's such hard work. And my respect for teachers just went through the roof. I mean, it is a really difficult job being a teacher. You have to not only educate, but you have to motivate, entertain, maintain authority, all these things simultaneously. And I just thought, oh, I can't do this. This is just too hard. And it's not me. So I came back into my final year of university thinking, I haven't a clue what I want to do with the rest of my life. And I was lucky enough, I was going around a careers fair with lots of stands with prospective employers, and I picked up a leaflet for the Foreign Office, and I read this brochure, and I thought, wow, this is just what I want to do. I can get to travel, I get to do different work at different times, so that I would never get bored, I get to learn foreign languages. For me, it was my dream job, and I went through the recruitment processes, which were fairly tough, and I understand that the year that I applied, they actually only took 1% of the people who applied. So when I got through, to say I was over the moon, I was ecstatic. I think I was sharing a house with 14 other students, and I opened the letter about 8 one morning, and those who were still asleep weren't asleep for very long because they're screams of pleasure. And I just feel so blessed that I have had this opportunity to do a job which I adore. I think I'm extremely privileged. To be able to do this job, to go to countries, to meet some incredible people. And I don't just mean the famous people, the big names. I mean, that's always gives me a buzz anyway. But it's the normal
today,
people.
For example.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yes, of course.
I am sitting opposite two wonderful gentlemen. What a rare pleasure.
That's called diplomacy, Jo. That's called diplomacy.
But it's the normal everyday people you meet, and you see such wonderful qualities in them. I remember going to Dartel Providencia for a visit as part of the work that I do with the Vodafone Foundation. And I remember chatting to this girl called Claire, who was about 20, 21, young girl. And I said, you know, what motivates you to do this job? And she said, well, just look at their faces. I feel as though I do so little for them, but the reward I get is huge. I go home every day knowing that I've made a difference. And I thought, wow, that really touched me. Because, you know, to me, that girl Claire, she's somebody special. Because she's doing something that not many people would do. It's hard work. You know, the job that she does.
Extremely hard work.
Exactly. But I feel very privileged to meet people like her. as well as the famous people. And it's also people like the war veterans, you know, and the charity workers and all these other people who are just normal, everyday people, but they're doing something to try and make a difference in society. And for me, that's a wonderful privilege to get to meet these people. So I feel I'm the luckiest person in the world. I've got the best job in the world. Don't tell all my colleagues in the Foreign Office.
we'll broadcast this in Maltese.
In fact, li samijat għan għet tisimaw il-programm mux kelma bejt nejn l-intervista tal-BOV jien Father Joe Borch, flimkien ma' l-Professur Joe Perotta għet intervistaw il-High Commissioner Ingliża, Louise Stanton. Pa' magħna u wara din il-pawza nerġaw inkomplu bil-programm.
Tkun xi tkun it-triq li tagħżel matul ħajtek, aħna nistgħu ngħinuk tfassal pjan finanzjarju li jaqdi l-ħtiġijiet tiegħek. Kellimna issa. Bank of Valletta. Impenn lejn is-suċċess tiegħek. Il-Bank of Valletta huwa licenzjat sabiex jipprovdi servizzi ta' investiment mill-MFSA.
Before the break, you were telling us that what motivated you to join the Foreign Office was that you wanted to travel.
Mm.
Okay?
Yes.
A lot of sailors said that, and I remember the old song, I joined the Navy to see the world, and what did I see? I saw the sea. And I'm sure there are quite a number of people who joined the Foreign Office to see the world, but only saw a desk. What makes the difference between those who only see desks and those who can fulfill their ambition?
Most people who join the Foreign Office do serve overseas, because that's why they join the Foreign Office. We're one of the few government departments to always meet our recruitment targets every year, although the pay is not so good as some of the other government departments, but for us it's that, you know, it's the X factor, you know, the fact that you can travel. And I feel really privileged because when I travel, often it's not just as a tourist. I'm not just seeing the tourist sites. I'm getting to meet the people of the country that I go to and see the real side of it. So, you know, I think everybody in the Foreign Office, that's why we join the Foreign Office. And yes, there are some people who choose after a while to stay at home. You know, they might have elderly parents or children doing A-levels or they have reasons they want to stay in the UK. And that's great because it means there's more opportunities overseas for those who want to go overseas. But I think it's really important that everybody in the Foreign Office has that overseas exposure to understand what it's like. Because it's very different working overseas to working in London.
You had an interesting article in the Times before the Pope's visit, where you touched on a number of interesting things. One was the, also in connection with the Pope's visit, the position of the Vatican and the British government on the Millennium Goals, on climate change, and also on the role of religion in secular society.
Yes.
So these are three different subjects, all of them of great interest. Let's take them one by one.
Okay.
Let's start from the role of religion in a secularized society.
Mm-hmm.
In the light of the Pope's visit to Great Britain, I was rereading yesterday, because I was writing my blog to the Times of Malta.com on the Pope's speech in Westminster. The Pope's speech in Westminster.
Yes.
Which was, I think, a fantastic speech.
It was, yeah.
Even though Pope Benedict, the speeches of Pope Benedict are usually very, very good speeches.
Mm.
I think that was one of the best. How do you look, coming from a country which is getting secularized and pluralized, where some people say we should not celebrate Christmas? How do you feel about the subject?
I think it's important to recognise that, I mean, Britain is a multicultural society these days, but there should be room for everybody. So there should be room for those who want to say celebrate Christmas and call it Christmas, not, you know, Winterval or Happy Holidays, which is one of my bugbears. We should be proud of our Christian roots, but also sensitive to when that might impinge on others. But I think it's about recognising that all faiths have room in our society, and they all play a very valuable role in building our communities. And I think sometimes it can be that sense of community can be lost when people don't belong to a church or involve themselves some other way in the community by doing charity work or volunteer work. I think the coalition government's policy on the big society is fantastic, getting people more involved in their own communities and having a say in society in general. I think that's a super idea because we have lost something. There needs to be something more to lives than just our individual lives, and we all sort of do our own thing, that we need to come together as communities.
Fairness and tolerance, I think, are not only British values, but are part of the British DNA.
Yes.
But today you find in Great Britain Christians who feel that they are not being treated fairly. Are they exaggerating? Is there such kind of feeling in certain sectors of society? If you insult someone who is a Muslim, you will not get away with it. But if you insult Christian precepts, you get away with it. Is this fair assessment, or is this a lopsided assessment of the situation?
Sadly, I think it could be a fair assessment. It's because we're all still adjusting, I think, and our sensitivity levels are still, our sensitivity levels towards people, say Muslims, because it's not a faith that's been present in the UK for millennia, although it has been present in the UK for centuries. We're still adjusting. And I think we do need to be careful to ensure that we are equitable to all faiths, it's a difficult thing to get the balance right. It's something that constantly needs to be looked at. We recognise that we have failed in Britain to a certain extent when it comes to integration of Muslims, for example, because of what happened with the 7/7 bombings in London. So we haven't done as well as we think we did in the past, but we recognise that. We still don't have the right answer. It's one of those things that you have to continuously work at, but I think it's really important that while we bring in all these different cultures into the UK, we don't lose our own sense of identity. I think the move towards on integration, ensuring that immigrants learn to speak English, I think that's a really positive thing, because you did have groups of communities who didn't learn to speak English, so they could never integrate, and that's where you get the problems. So I think it's important that there's integration while still respecting the differences. If you see what I mean, everybody brings in something new and valuable to the mix, and it crosses all aspects of our culture in the UK, and it's great. I mean, Indian food is now one of the most popular types of food in the UK. I think it was Robin Cook who said chicken tikka masala is now the national dish.
Yeah, but he died.
And the, among your interests,
not because of chicken tikka masala. I have to say it's also one of my favourites.
Yeah, but among your interests are eating slow food and good wine.
Absolutely.
You mentioned immigrants learning English. Mm-hmm. Is it equivalent, or is it similar to saying diplomats learning Maltese?
Well, English is also an official language in Malta, so I speak one of your two official languages.
This week we heard Angela Merkel. Mm-hmm. Declaring in what I think was very strong terms, saying that integration has failed, social integration has failed in Germany. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons she gives for this is one that you have already mentioned, which is that the refusal to learn the German language, in this case, and this building of enclaves where this is not Germany, you've entered there and it's Little Turkey, and so on. Now, I'd like you to answer this question not as the High Commissioner, but as Miss Louise Stanton, okay? I'm making this difference on purpose. Don't you think that, in fact, if there's going to be social integration, and for it to work, there has to be a real effort for the immigrant to actually become part of that society, and that therefore there must be some kind of lever to push these immigrants in that direction, and that in Britain this was never so?
I think there certainly wasn't the opportunities in the past, and there wasn't the pressure for immigrants to learn English, for example. But I think it's important that immigrants are able to retain their cultural identity but still be British. You can be simultaneously both. You know, because immigrants do add a huge amount to our society. They are net contributors to Britain's wealth. They proportionately contribute more to our GDP than the percentage of the population. So they are contributors, and I think it's important to recognise that they do bring added value to the UK. But we do need to, there are things that we need to address, and language is one of them, because you can never have a society that is properly integrated if the different parts of it can't communicate together. Because everything boils down to being able to communicate, because once you can communicate, you can gain a much better understanding of each other's cultures and faiths. Because I find it amazing how many people do not understand that there is a close interrelationship between Christianity and Islam, that Muslims believe Jesus was a prophet. You know, there are real basic misunderstandings between people. And I think to be able to address that, we need to communicate and educate. And that isn't just the immigrants, but also the permanent residents.
But don't you think that historically... there was a given disadvantage in this cultural integration element, in the sense that most of these immigrants came from countries which were ex-British colonies. Mm-hmm. So you have a double perception at work here. You have the British perception, which grew over the time of empire, where to be British was inherently to be superior. There was this element among the British population. Look at the songs, look at the writings and newspapers of the time, and so on and so forth. And at the same time, you had the other side of the picture of these immigrants coming in with a sense of inherent inferiority. You know, they're coming up, they need to measure up now, because they're going to be part of Britain. And don't you think that there was no real effort to actually address this historical reality at an official level and to do something to try and smooth the edges, if you like?
Well, immigration is not a 20th century phenomenon in the UK.
It's true.
I mean, you could go all the way back, you know, the Romans, when they invaded dominated the Celts, and we had the Angles, the Saxons, and so on. We had the Normans, you know, and you had the Jewish settlers coming in, you had the Gypsies coming in the 16th century, and the 18th century had Muslims. In fact, the Romans were the people who first introduced black people into the United Kingdom. So, you know, immigration is not just a 20th century issue. It has been happening over the millennia.
Yes,
it's a natural human phenomenon.
I'm sure you agree with me if I say that the British perception of immigrants has changed drastically from what it used to be especially where coloured people were concerned. It wasn't religion mostly, it was a question of colour. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Britain was out of step with the rest of Europe.
No.
I'm not singling out Britain, but we're talking about Britain. To what it is today. Before, when you had immigrants coming in, to a large majority, especially if they weren't white, they were going to be condemned to low-paying jobs and so on. There was this social difference.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any appetite or anything like that. I'm not suggesting that. But there was this this perception.
Yes.
And against which these immigrants had to fight in order to establish themselves. Now, what I'm saying is, don't you think that from the official side, there was never any real push to try and make things easier for both sides? You know, for the British people to understand these immigrants and for the immigrants to understand their position and how they could actually improve it.
It's difficult because the society norms have changed so much. I mean, what was considered acceptable in the 1940s and 50s is completely unacceptable these days. And I mean, I think it's only right that the UK does acknowledge that the people who came from the Caribbean in the 40s and 50s, the Indians, the Pakistanis and Bangladeshis in the 60s and 70s,
were going to contribute, to quote one person, and I'm doing this on purpose, to rivers of blood. You remember that speech?
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, way before my time.
Oh, yeah, it was. Not before my time.
Now, I don't recall the exact details of, I think it was Enoch Powell's speech.
That's right, Enoch Powell.
But the thing is, those people came to the United Kingdom to occupy the lower paid jobs, the jobs that we couldn't fill. But they were contributing to society, they were helping the economy. These days, however, you know, that's all shifted because you have second generation, you have third generation Indians or Caribbean, ethnic Caribbean Britons. And they consider themselves to be 100% British. And they are contributing at all levels in our society. You find, they are well educated and operate at all levels. So they have, I think a lot of people really have integrated in that sense. So it's a difficult one. I can't, you know, the past is what the past was, but we are now where we are, and what we need to do is look towards the future and think about, you know, we still haven't got this quite right, and try and address those problems and move forward. I really liked Lord Coe, when talking about the 2012 Olympic bid, one of the comments he made was that all the teams who are going to be competing in the 2012 Olympics will have a home crowd, because London is so multi-ethnic. I think that's a lovely concept, that no matter where you come from, for the London 2012 Olympics, you're always going to have some supporters cheering you on.
Infakt ru semijata naqtisamu il-program mux kelma bejtnej l-intervista tal-BOV jinfader ġo borx minn kima l-professur ġo perot għat intervistaw il-High Commissioner Ingliża Louise Stanton pawmana nerġon komplu għara din il-pawsa.
Tkun xi tkun it-triq li tażel matul ħajtek, aħna nistgħu ngħinuk tfassal pjan finanzjarju li jaqdi l-ħtiġijiet tiegħek. Kellimna issa Bank of Valletta. Impenn lejn is-suċċess tiegħek. Il-Bank of Valletta huwa licenzjat sabiex jipprovdi servizzi ta' investiment mill-MFSA.
In a recent article you wrote about the Millennium Development Goals, you said that Britain is determined to keep on contributing to the achievement of these goals. And even you refer to the commitment that 0.7% of the gross national income will go towards development aid. Was this affected in the recent cuts?
No. We see that as being a really important element of our foreign policy. You could also say it's self-interest, however, because, you know, all of these problems that I've mentioned in my articles before are interrelated. So we need to help the poorest in the world come out of poverty and raise the standards of health and particularly maternal health, stopping so many newborn babies from dying. Malaria comes into it, access to clean water, primary school education. All of these things it's helping Africa, but it's also in all our interests in Europe as well, because as Malta has seen with the problems with illegal immigrants, many of them are fleeing conflict, but many of them are fleeing poverty.
Exactly.
One of the causes of conflict is lack of natural resources and poverty again. So we keep coming back to this. It's a sort of a big circle. And you can throw climate change into the mix as well, because you know, if temperatures rise as the experts are predicting and we don't do anything to stop it, then Africa is going to become much more barren. Droughts will happen much more frequently, crops will fail, and the poverty will become even worse. So it's a really complex mix of issues, and I know the temptation is just to put it in the too difficult pile, because, you know, where do you start with such a big problem? But the solution is to break it down into these smaller goals, like the Millennium Development Goals, and try and make a difference and lift millions of people out of poverty so that they do have access to water, primary education, and so on.
Great Britain was a great empire, and because of that it had a lot of importance in the world. Today Great Britain is a relatively medium-sized country, not to say a small country. But it still, I think, has more importance on the international scene than its size and than its population. So in a certain sense, Britain is still living on its past. Will this end at some time?
Well, geographically we may be small, but we are the sixth biggest economy in the world. So, you know, that gives us stature. You know, we are part of the G7, and I think it's really important that the big economies like the UK and the other G7, the G20 members tackle the big issues, because you're never going to be able to tackle the issues of global importance unless you've got the biggest economies on board.
I may be completely misinterpreting what I'm going to say. It won't be the first time. But I look at the cuts that have just taken place or are about to take place, those that have been announced, especially in the Defense Department, as mirroring the kind of cuts which happened following the Defense White Paper of February 1957 after Suez, where the armed forces were to be cut by 50% in 4 years' time. Now, my question is this. Don't you think that historically one of the reasons why there was a need for the kind of cuts that happened in 57, the kind of cuts that happened now, I know there was a recession, but that aside, was because after the war, Great Britain or British governments refused to cut their coat according to their cloth. They continued to wear the apparel of a world power while they did not have the economic clout to underpin that power. Would you agree with me?
I would agree that the UK has definitely overspent in recent years. We know that because we've got a huge deficit. We do need to cut back to reduce that deficit. The interest alone at the moment is £25 million a day. So I agree we do need to cut our cloth smaller because we do have less money. And that is part of the, you know, we've been affected like many others by the global recession. And, you know, this is why the government says we have to cut back radically to bring our spending back down in line with our income. And at the moment, a good chunk of our income is actually going on paying off our deficit. So the cuts are completely necessary. We have to do it. Some people have asked me how it's going to impact on the High Commission here in Malta. My answer is that I don't know yet. Although the Foreign Office has its headline figure, I won't know what my budget will be until January next year. And some people have suggested, well, can't you tell them that, you know, this is different here in Malta?
That sounds very Maltese.
And my answer to that is I don't want to say that we're different, because I believe it's the responsibility of all of us who work for the government to implement those cuts and to do what's necessary for the greater good.
If we look at...
No, I was just going to remark that she answered my question by not answering it, which is a diplomat's way of speaking very often, but I'll let that go.
Okay, but... I remember from school days, which are quite a few years back, a cartoon in our history book. I remember it vaguely, so I don't know the details. Someone in Great Britain looking across the channel, there is the fog, and mm-hmm. he's saying, Europe, the continent, is isolated.
Europe cut off.
Yeah. not Great Britain. And... you have a big debate in Great Britain between those who are pro-Europe and those who are not so enthusiastic about Europe. What is the position of the present government in this controversy?
The government understands that there are many people in the UK who feel that they don't have a say in what happens in the EU, and this is something that the government wants to address, which is why they put a treaty lock on, that we don't want to have any transfers of competence or powers during this government, and there's going to be a new EU bill which will sort of set this out, and included in that bill will be a sovereignty clause which will basically say that whatever Parliament can do, Parliament can also undo. Because there is this fear in the UK that, EU law has precedence over UK law, which we don't believe to be the case. You know, common law is quite clear on this, that UK law, at the end of the day, does take precedence, but the government wants to spell this out in the new sovereignty clause to address that growing feeling in the UK.
But that was always the case. No parliament ever bound another parliament.
Exactly. Well, yes. I mean, laws are always made by the government of the day, and each government can make their own laws.
Yeah, but the way it happens is that there is a directive, and then national parliaments make it their own law, so it becomes a law. Mm-hmm. Not because parliaments adopt it. Mm. And I think it should also be the same with Great Britain.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very frustrating. As somebody who works on EU issues a lot, I understand the many benefits that the EU, membership of the EU, can bring. But I think that's not so widely known in the UK. People are just naturally more cynical towards the EU. And this is what the government, the coalition government, wants to try and address and ensure that people don't feel that the EU is sort of encroaching on UK areas. And
hands off the British sausage.
I think all countries in the EU have their own unique things.
We are almost at the end of the interview, so I'll ask you a very easy question and a very difficult question. Tell me something you like and something you dislike about the Maltese.
What do I like? I love their zest for life, the fact that people are so energetic, sociable, hospitable. I could go to 6 parties every night because there's always something going on. And that's what I love, that aspect of the Maltese. One aspect I don't like is the incidence of racism that you read about in the newspapers, and that saddens me. But it's not just from Maltese people. I hear that from Brits living here too. You know, their attitudes are attitudes that, you know, may have been acceptable several decades ago, but not in this modern world. And I think that's such a shame because, you know, Malta is such, Malta is so proud of their Christian faith. And yet you don't see these Christian values coming through when you read about incidents of racism.
Okay. Ringrazio ħafna l-High Commissioner Ingliża, Luigi Stantena, dell'intervista tagħha. Jiena Fadel Joe Bolf flimkien mal-Professur Joe Perotta nirringrazzjaw lilkom tal-attenzjoni tagħkom u nagħmlu appuntament malkom għal bħallum ġimgħa. Saħħa.
Għadkom kemm smajtu. Mhux kelma bejtnej. L-intervista tal-Bank of Valletta. Produzzjoni u prezentazzjoni ta' Fader Joe Borch u l-Professur Joe Perotta. Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqat tajba tal-Bank of Valletta.